In the 1950s, the annual TV broadcast of The Wizard of Oz became a ritual. Every year, new children were introduced to the film, while other children and adults watched it again and again. It's hard to find anyone who hasn't seen or doesn't love The Wizard of Oz. August 15th marks the 50th anniversary of this film classic. My guest, Algene Harmetz, is the author of The Making of The Wizard of Oz. A new edition of her 1977 book has been published to coincide with the anniversary. Harmetz has covered the movie industry for The New York Times since 1978. She told me about the scene in The Wizard of Oz that affected her most when she first saw it as a child.
To me, the scariest moment in the movie was the moment when Dorothy is locked in the witch's castle, the sand in the hourglass is running out, and she manages to get Aunt Em into the witch's crystal ball and begs for help, and all of a sudden Aunt Em's face is replaced by the face of the witch saying, "Auntie Em, Auntie Em," was terrifying to me.
So what kind of makeup and prosthetics did she wear?
Margaret Hamilton actually had a green makeup with a copper base. And unlike Haley and Bolger and Lahr, she didn't have terrible prosthetics. Bolger, for instance, had a mask over his entire face. Lahr had a mask which showed only a bit of chin and his eyes, and once it was on, he couldn't eat, so he had to sip his lunch. Margaret Hamilton didn't have that problem. But she was immobilized by the fact that she was coated. Her hands, her face, her arms were all coated with this green paint. And she couldn't do anything for herself. As she said, that included the amenities in the bathroom. So she had to have this little girl who was assigned to her as a kind of maid who helped lift her skirts and also held her peanut butter sandwich when she was eating her lunch. Her rubber pieces on her face, it did take a fairly long time. It took a couple of hours each day. The worst part was this terribly ugly wart. And it had sort of large black hairs protruding from it. And Margaret Hamilton was never a very attractive woman, except on the inside, where she was utterly lovely. But in terms of her look, she was a homely woman, even at the age of 30. And so I think she got more embarrassed and more unhappy than most people would out of being made uglier.
There's a great scene. This is just when Dorothy has arrived in Oz, and her house has killed the Wicked Witch of the East. The Good Witch gives Dorothy the ruby slippers, and the Wicked Witch of the West wants to take those slippers for herself. I wanted to play a clip from that scene.
"Give me back my slippers. I'm the only one that knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well."
"Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone before somebody drops a house on you too."
"Very well. I'll bide my time. And as for you, my fine lady, it's true, I can't attend you here and now as I'd like. But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too."
Well, in that explosion, that's the explosion where the Wicked Witch of the West disappears in red smoke and fire. What actually happened during one of the takes of that was that Margaret Hamilton caught on fire. Can you describe what went wrong?
Yes. They had done it before lunch, and they had gotten one take, but the director, Victor Fleming, wanted more for insurance. And as Margaret Hamilton described it to me, what she did was she came back from lunch, and everybody was a little loggy, and they weren't really going very quickly. They were sort of too full. And four or five times, things went wrong. The smoke didn't come up. She didn't disappear properly. And finally, Victor Fleming, who was very much of a Tartar, got extremely angry, and he said, "As soon as she gets her foot on top of that piece of yellow brick road, I want you to..." Well, she was to stand on a square of the yellow brick road, which was in actuality a hydraulic lift, an elevator which would take her underneath the stage. And she raised her hand and she said rather timidly, both feet, please, Mr. Fleming. She was not afraid of being burned. It had never occurred to her. She was afraid of breaking her leg. If both of her feet were not properly on that small square of yellow brick road and she had to back up to get on it, she was not walking to it, she was walking backwards to it, she was very much afraid that she would break a leg. So the next time they did the shot, the smoke and the fire came up, she disappeared underneath the stage and she felt a slight sensation of warmth. But when she got underneath the stage, the two stagehands who were stationed there to help her off ran at her, grabbed her broom, grabbed her hat off of her head, and she suddenly realized that her broom had caught fire. The broomstick part had been, the straw part had been right underneath her chin. The whole right side of her face was burned, her right eyebrow was burned off, and her right hand was badly burned. She went home, and she was not needed again for 6 weeks, which was lucky for her because of the fact that MGM would simply have replaced her. They didn't have to because she had the time to recover. But in the rest of the movie, she had to wear a green glove on the right hand because it did not allow itself to have grease paint or even to be touched after that.
Now, why didn't she sue them?
You didn't sue the studios in those days. As she said to me, if I had threatened to sue them, you know, I'd never have worked again. As a matter of fact, she told me about a conversation she had, which she found very queer, where somebody from the studio called her up, and after the conversation was over, she realized that they must have had a secretary on the line taking notes, because the fellow was saying things, well, you're not really hurt, are you? And she had the presence of mind to say, well, yes, of course I am. But she didn't sue them because she wanted to work in Hollywood again.
My guest is Al Jean Harmetz, who covers Hollywood for the New York Times and is the author of the book The Making of the Wizard of Oz. And the book has just been republished in recognition of the 50th anniversary of the film's opening. This film was really a vehicle for Judy Garland. However, we almost got to see Shirley Temple in the lead. Who wanted Shirley Temple to play the role?
The money men in New York. The creative people connected with the movie, Arthur Freed and Mervyn LeRoy, wanted Judy Garland from the very beginning. Actually, Arthur Freed was one of the people who was a Judy Garland backer at MGM. He was a young songwriter, a young assistant producer in the 40s, and 50s, he would make the greatest musicals at the studio that made the greatest musicals in that golden age of musicals. He would make Meet Me in St. Louis. He would win the Academy Award for American in Paris. In those days, he was just a young, ambitious man. And he had helped bring Judy Garland to the studio. He had sponsored her there. She had come 3 years earlier as a girl of 13. And he saw her as the only person to play Dorothy. Unfortunately, the money men in New York wanted box office insurance. And what better box office insurance than Shirley Temple? She'd been the top box office star in America in 1935, 1936, and 1937. MGM's Clark Gable had been a distant second to Shirley Temple. So L.B. Mayer tried to borrow Shirley Temple from 20th Century Fox. If he had succeeded, she would have played in the movie, no matter what the creative people wanted. Luckily, Daryl F. Zanuck did not loan her out.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine Shirley Temple singing a song with the musical range and emotional depth of Over the Rainbow. But speaking of Over the Rainbow, that song was actually almost removed from the movie.
Yes, it was. It was after the film was completed. They used to preview pictures by taking a private car and putting it on the red trolley line and taking it out to one of the outlying districts. In the case of The Wizard of Oz, it went down to San Bernardino, about an hour and a half away from Los Angeles. Usually a lot of the producers on the lot would go along. And after the movie was over, they came to Mayer and they said, no MGM star can sing in a barnyard. Now, Mervyn LeRoy, the producer of the movie, said to me years and years and years later that he thought that they were jealous and that's why they wanted the song removed. I don't know if they were jealous or if they really thought it was beneath the dignity of an MGM star to sing in a barnyard, but indeed, Mayer took it out, took the song out of the movie, and it was Arthur Freed, along with the lyricist E.Y. Harburg, who shouted and screamed and begged and got Mayer eventually to put it back in again. And then, of course, Over the Rainbow won one of the two Academy Awards that The Wizard of Oz won in 1939. It lost almost everything else to Gone with the Wind, but it defeated Gone with the Wind in terms of the original score.
Because the lyricist E.Y. Harburg edited part of the script for the movie and also wrote some of the sequences himself, he was able to write the lead-in into the songs. And I think that was a liberty afforded few songwriters who really lost control of their songs once the movie was being made. He wrote the spoken passage into Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And you write a little bit about that in the book.
Yes. What was very special about the movie was that it was one of the very few times in the 30s when the songs in a movie actually advanced the plot. Most places, the songs were sort of like raisins dropped into a plum pudding. They were sort of nice to have, but if you'd taken them out, the whole thing would have been exactly the same. In terms of musicals, Love Me Tonight was the first time that that was done. And Harburg and Arlen were able to do it on The Wizard of Oz. They were able to make each of the songs. For instance, Over the Rainbow definitely was the heart of the movie because it was the yearning of Dorothy to get away someplace where she wouldn't have any troubles. And so it told you in song exactly what was going to happen and where she was going to find herself. Cole Porter, for instance, had the experience of having them buy one of his plays, make it into a movie, and take out all the songs and put in about six other songs instead.
Let me play this transition from the dialogue into the song of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I believe this transition was written by the lyricist E.Y. Harburg, yes?
Yes, he was able to do that.
Okay, here we go.
Annie, really? You know what Miss Gus said she was going to do to Toto? She says she
now,
was going to...
Now, Dorothy, dear, stop imagining things. You always get yourself into a fret over nothing. Uh-huh. Now, you just help us out today and find yourself a place where you won't get into any trouble.
Some place where there isn't any trouble.
Do you suppose there is such a place, Toto?
There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon, beyond the rain.
How old was Judy Garland when she made The Wizard of Oz?
Judy was 16 years old. So she actually had her 17th birthday during the filming of the movie. In L. Frank Baum's book, Dorothy was a child of five or six. And in an attempt to make Judy Garland into, I think, what would have been the equivalent of, say, a 12-year-old, she was corseted, severely corseted, to hold her breasts down. And she was put into the costume, actually, that came out of the book. They did that in almost every case. They tried to recreate the characters' costumes or the way they looked in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, published by L. Frank Baum in 1900.
I always like to imagine how movies would look if all the original actors that were supposed to be cast in it ended up in the final production. We had talked about how Shirley Temple was almost cast in the Judy Garland part, and but Buddy Ebsen was originally cast in the role of the Tin Man.
Actually, he was originally cast as the Scarecrow. If people at the studio, various people that had their druthers, this is the cast you would have seen in The Wizard of Oz. Buddy Ebsen as the Scarecrow, Ray Bolger as the Tin Man, Shirley Temple as Dorothy, W.C. Fields as the Wizard, and Gail Sondergaard as a very slinky, glamorous Wicked Witch with sequins. First thing that happened was that Ray Bolger, who had always wanted to play the Scarecrow, he'd seen a touring performance of the play when he was a young boy, went to L.B. Mayer and he begged him to allow him to switch roles with Buddy Ebsen and to become the Scarecrow. He said that, quite properly, he said he was a soft shoe dancer, that he was not stiff. He was a floppy dancer, and Mayer did allow this. Buddy Ebsen, who was a young dancer under contract to the studio, didn't care just so long as he was in the movie. It didn't matter to him if he was a Tin Man or if he was a Scarecrow. And so he took over the role of the Tin Man, and about 10 days into the shooting, he took a deep breath one night, and he couldn't breathe, and he was rushed to the hospital, put in an oxygen tent. He had been poisoned by his makeup. Essentially, the aluminum dust that they powdered on his face, he had inhaled and it had coated his lungs. And the studios were no more gentlemanly then than they are now, so learning that he wouldn't be available for a few weeks, they simply replaced him with Jack Haley.
There really were quite a few accidents and toxic poisoning type of incidents on The
Yes,
Wizard of
well,
Oz.
When Haley came in, A, they didn't tell him what had happened to Ebsen. Didn't really tell anybody what had happened to Ebsen. And B, they made sure they didn't powder aluminum dust on his face. What they did was they put on a white chalky material to close his pores, and then they painted over it with an aluminum paste. So he didn't have anything to breathe in. However, some of the paste got in his eye and caused a serious eye infection.
Was this pretty typical of movies with special effects at the time, that that actors and people working on the sound stages would end up with health problems because of the materials they were working with?
Oh, absolutely. One of the technicians who was in the special effects department told me, just with almost awe in his voice, he said, he told me how they made the breakaway glass that Burt Lahr jumped through when he jumped out of the wizard's throne room. It was a sugary material, and he said it was on a bed of mercury, a pool of mercury. And he just, even 35 years, 40 years later, he shivered. He said, we didn't know anything. We didn't know how harmful it was. We were working with mercury. We didn't know anything about it at all. When they made the cyclone, the guy who stood up on top of the stage and pushed Fuller's earth into the muslin windsock that they were using as a cyclone, said that for days afterwards he was spitting up sulfur and yellow mucus. Nobody paid very much attention to safety in those days.
My guest is Algene Harmetz, and we're talking about her book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz. You wrote The Making of The Wizard of Oz over 10 years ago. It's just been republished in honor of the anniversary of the release of the film. When you wrote it, there were more people alive who participated in the making of this movie than there are now. You must feel really glad to have been able to speak to them when you did, and I'm thinking about how unreliable the film reporting of the time must have been as a source, because the film reporting was so loaded with lies that were concocted by the studio publicists.
Absolutely. There was a 16-page press material that was put out by Howard Strickling, the head of MGM's publicity department, and there isn't one statement in that whole thing that's true. And it's just amazing. It said things like there were 500 munchkins in the movie. There were 6,000 people who worked on the movie. Well, there were only 3,000 people at the studio at the time. Every single thing. I mean, they just made it up out of whole cloth. I think people's memories are much better, actually. And I was extremely lucky because now everyone connected with the movie is dead. Margaret Hamilton, Ray Bolger, Mervyn LeRoy, Buddy Gillespie, who did all of the special effects, Jack Haley, all of those people were alive, and I was able to do hours and hours and hours of tape recording with them.
Well, I want to thank you for telling us a little bit about what happened behind the scenes of The Wizard of Oz. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you very much, Terry.